Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is an encore presentation of The Brian Lehrer Show. Don't even think about calling in. So maybe you know of the father of my next guest, longtime New York Times book critic Anatole Breuillard. He kept a secret from his children. Just before his death from prostate cancer, my guest Bliss Breuillard and her brother learned that their dad was part black but had chosen to live as white. He could pass. She writes about what that family secret says about race, family, identity, and reconciliation in a new memoir called One Drop, My Father's Hidden Life, a story of race and family secrets. And Bliss Breuillard joins us now. Bliss, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Glad to be here.
You're right. I felt like I mattered in a way I hadn't before when you found out about your racial heritage. What did you mean?
Well, it seemed like a lot more of an interesting history than being just merely Norwegian and French. And also, that was my sort of initial response, which was excitement and even, oh, this is cool, to have a multiracial background. And as I've learned more about it, learned my father's family's history and met my family, there's a lot more pain that's been mixed in with it.
Well, tell us a little bit about your father and his choice to pass as white.
Sure. His family, his parents were both mixed race, actually. They were Creoles from New Orleans, where for the better part of a century and a half, Creoles were actually legally segregated from both white people and slaves. They couldn't marry into either group. So as a result, they kind of developed their own culture. They spoke French and they were Catholic. And so that was one of the reasons why I think the label of African-American was always a difficult fit for my father. His family left New Orleans in 1927 when he was 6 and a half and moved up to Bed-Stuy, actually. It was then Stuyvesant Heights. But I think that then as he was growing up, it was very clear in the 1930s and 40s it was much easier to be white. His parents both had to pass for work. And so all that kind of encouraged my dad, or discouraged him, really, from embracing a black identity.
Now, he kept the secret from you and your brother, but not from everybody.
No, I had a really hard time breaking the news to anyone. As a matter of fact, I told a childhood friend at my father's memorial service where I met my aunt, my father's sister, for the first time, my cousin, and saw his other sister for the first time in 17 years. And I said to my friend, who I've known most of my life, those were my aunts back there, and that was my cousin. They were black. My father, they're black. My father's black. I didn't know. And she said that, you know, she knew, that she'd always known, that her parents had told her, but she just thought I didn't want to talk about it, which made me feel really misunderstood.
How did her parents know?
Everybody knew. It was just, you know, a lot of people just thought it was, you know, one great-grandparent somewhere. I mean, it was just kind of good gossip. And his friends were mostly liberals, writers, artists. It really wouldn't make much of a difference to them.
And you wrote about the difficulty that you had reconnecting to your father's sisters.
Yeah, I think for his more distant relatives, for my second and third cousins, it's been a lot easier because the rejection hasn't been personal. But, you know, for my father's most of his life and all of my life until I was 24, we had kept them at bay. And as a matter of fact, my Aunt Shirley, you know, had to tell her son when he was young, you know, why don't we see our Uncle Anatole? And so she had to say, well, because they're being white and they don't want to know us because we're black. And I think that must have been a very difficult conversation to have. And so there's just a lot of pain there to get over. And it's hard to start a relationship, you know, after 24 years have passed.
I guess. How complicated was it for your father to keep that kind of distance from his sisters and even shelter you from them?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, one sister he did see who could also pass and did in the 40s to get work, but she later on identified as African-American, and he did see her. So there wasn't a sense completely that my father's family was, you know, cut out of our lives. He would talk about his one sister and his mother occasionally. And his other sister, it was more that they just didn't get along. So it did, and my mother's family, we didn't see that much either, so it seemed somewhat normal.
My guest on WNYC is Bliss Breuillard, talking about her memoir, One Drop, My Father's Hidden Life, a story of race and family secrets. And I want to open up the phones. You know, we've looked at truth and reconciliation on this show, on the community level, even the national level. What about the family level for you? Listeners, do you come from a family made up of groups of groups on the opposite sides of the racial divide or the class divide, maybe even the political divide? How does the political, the racial, the class work itself out in your family? Have you tried to reconnect with disparate parts of your family? Hasn't been difficult. Has it been difficult for you? Call us 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or with any questions you have for Bliss Broyard, daughter of Anatole and author of One Drop, My Father's Hidden Life, A Story of Race and Family Secrets. Bliss, you reached out to not only your father's immediate family, but also the larger Broyard clan. How did you go about doing that, and how were you received?
Well, I went through the phone book in New Orleans. It was kind of amazing for me because in the Manhattan phone book, there were only, when I moved here, my first job out of college, my first apartment, it was just myself and then my Aunt Lorraine. And when I went to New Orleans, there were, you know, 30, 40 listings. And so I just started calling people. And I found, actually, there's quite a number of people in my family whose fathers or parents or grandparents also passed, and they have the same experience that I did. So we kind of teamed up together and started planning a family reunion where 100 people from both the black and white sides got together in New Orleans in 2001. But I think the thing that happens when there's secrets in a family is there's a lot of hesitancy to reach out. And some people were afraid to come to the reunion because they didn't know which side was planning it. And in fact, these three brothers from Miami came and I met them in the lobby and they said to me, "What are all these black people doing at our family reunion?"
Wow, because he didn't know.
No, but you know, we looked at them. We said, "Well, what did you all grow up as?" And I said, our mother said that we were Mexican. And you know, it's better to be Mexican in Miami, I guess, than being black. Huh. But I have some other family members in New Orleans. There's been a lot of press in the New Orleans papers about this, who were living as white. And as a result of my book, they told their kids. And I guess they're taking it pretty well.
So you didn't tell the family members on the invitation to this reunion of both sides of the family what they were getting themselves into.
No, but it was wonderful. It was very, you know, healing to all come together. And even within the people that stayed in the black community, there was a lot of difficulty of, you know, there's a lot of color consciousness within the black community. And some people thought that their cousins were looking down on them because they were lighter skinned. And, you know, these are the older generation. And so there was a lot of kind of good that came out of this reconnection.
Your family history is really emblematic of the American tapestry. What does your story tell us about the melting pot analogy?
Well, I think that, you know, we think of multiracial identity as being kind of a 90s phenomenon, a 1990s phenomenon. And really, at least in Louisiana and many other parts of the South, it's been going on for centuries. And so we've been a mixed multiracial nation for many, many generations. And I think just now, though, people are being kind of allowed to embrace that.
Do you think that some of the same tensions or identity questions that play out in society at large are now playing out in your family?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's still, you know, as of 2000, people could identify themselves with all ethnicities that apply or all races that apply.
But on the U.S. Census.
That's right. And many schools and state forms have, I think they were actually legally required to follow suit. But still many people you know, just think in these categories of black and white. And so I think that there's some in my family who, and certainly people that I've met along the way, who sort of insist on choosing. And a Creole identity is, Creole is mixed. And, it, you know, you're in, kind of in the middle.
Deborah in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC with Bliss Broyard. Hello, Deborah.
Hi. Yeah, when I listen to her, I think a lot about what my family has gone through. When I was young, I think I was 10 or 11, I was in St. Louis for Thanksgiving, and we were all of a sudden told, oh, we're going to a family reunion, and that my grandmother, who I had always known as my grandmother, wasn't really my grandmother, but my dad had a mother who had died when he was a young child. I never really got the whole story, but I walked into this room, and there were, like, all of these cousins, like 50, 60, 70 people, and one of them, it turned out, was a cousin, first cousin of mine, who was my camp counselor at camp. And here was a person who was a relative who my dad knew was at the same camp as me, but we weren't identified with her as family.
Why weren't you told, do you think?
Well, I think that there was a lot of pain from my father losing his mother. And now, it's as I've aged, he has one cousin who's really pretty much kept herself intentionally in our lives. My daughter just had her bat mitzvah, and this cousin, who's now 80 years old, came to the bat mitzvah, you know, alone, intentionally, you know, to kind of keep his family as part of my family. Hmm. And I just found out my daughter was diagnosed recently with a health problem that turns out is related to the family of health issues that my biological grandmother had suffered from.
Huh.
And I discussed this with his first cousin. She was telling me, oh, you have like 54, your father had 54 first cousins. I have family all over this country.
So what did you do when you discovered all of this?
It's hard because it's just beginning to sink in. This is very recent in the last few weeks that we had this special occasion. So it's hard because I have family now. You know, I have cousins that, you know, in Philadelphia, San Francisco, Los Angeles, places where I have been or where I have a sibling who has gone to live or visit.
So your whole sense
of... He hadn't shared it.
And so your whole sense of identity is being shaken up. And Bliss, and Deborah, thank you for your call. Sound familiar?
Yes, it does. I mean, I think what often happens when there's a family secret is that it becomes not so much about the content of the secret itself, but the fact that it's been a secret for so long that a family member is protecting. Like in the case of the caller, you know, perhaps her father was protecting his mother that she really felt like the real mother, and he didn't want to, you know, question that in any way. And so it becomes about sort of protecting this kind of secret for a long time.
And she talked about the pain. In your first answer, you brought up the word pain. What's the pain?
Well, I think the pain is a lot of things. One, that I know that it was painful for my father. My mother described it as being more painful in a way than the cancer that had begun to invade his bones. And when he talked about it, it was only the second time she'd ever seen him cry in his life. And for him, I think it was the pain in his childhood of not fitting in anywhere. The darker-skinned black kids used to pick on him because he looked white, and the white kids ostracized him because they knew his family was black. And he told my mother he would come home from school, his jacket would be torn, and his parents wouldn't ask him what happened.
So you think he was trying to protect you from similar problems?
Absolutely. Many people I know who grew up looking white, you know, not having recognizably black characteristics, had a lot of confusion if they were black identified, because you have people always challenging you about what your identity is. And I think that can be very confusing. I think that where it's worked the best is their family has offset it with a really rich sense of black culture and give them a grounding in that identity.
So are you angry at him? Are you going through a forgiveness process?
Well, I think that was part of writing the book. I feel, you know, I worked on it for 7 years, and so I came to kind of see him in less heroic terms, more human, see his decision as somewhere between, you know, self-preservation and selfishness, and that's the way a lot of us have to live our lives.
What do you think he would think about this book being published?
I think that he would be pleased. After his mother died, his father died when he was fairly young, and his mother died actually when I was 12, and I didn't even see her at the end of her life. But he wrote an essay that appeared in this column he used to have in the New York Times, where he wrote that, like every great tradition, his family had to die before he realized how much they meant to him and that he missed them. And he wondered about my brother and I, whether we would ever kind of turn our back on him. And he said, or do they understand that after all these years of running away from home, I'm still trying to get back? So I've always taken that line as kind of my permission to get back to home for him.
Jessica in Belleville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Brian. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Well, I was calling in because I had sort of a mature discovery of my family's blackness, very similar to this. It wasn't until, I don't know, beyond college that I found out that... my father's mother is like from Richmond, Virginia, and she was Native American and Caucasian and African American. And, you know, I guess more than her brothers and sisters were able to do, she was able to kind of pass, like not pass for white, but she always like emphasized her Native Americanness and her Caucasianness. And the whole black thing was never discussed. And, you know, her hair was straight, and I on that side of the family, we have, like, African-American relatives, but it was always said that it was because of this cousin who married that friend from college who was actually black, and it's because of her that there's this aspect of our family. And it wasn't until I was older that I realized, like, no, it's us, and it's part of our heritage. And what's interesting is my mother's, like, from the Dominican Republic, and, you know, that kind of Caribbean heritage often implies a lot of mixing. There's a, you know, centuries of miscegenation, and she is, you know, she has an African ancestry and European, and but she only.
So it sounds like you already had multiple identities with Dominican and white, and you said Native American.
My father's from Peru, but that's, you know, not germane to your subject today.
Right. So once the black piece got added, how did that change you or your sense of yourself?
Well, for me, it was, in a way, I don't know if this is weird, but it was kind of a thrill. Like, I guess I had always sort of wanted to identify with the whole, like, American black experience in a way that was more personal or something like that. And then it was kind of that I get to. Is that weird?
Is that weird, or did you have the same thing?
No, I think probably anyone who was coming up in the 70s and 80s went through periods where, you know, they wanted to be black, at least as the experience was represented on television.
Yeah, there's a word for that. Wannabes.
Right, wiggers. But, you know, every day I hear from people who have the same story. And I think Ancestry.com, you can, you know, look up your family's race on the census reports online in a matter of minutes. So they're connecting a lot of people to their hidden ancestries.
That's right. Skip Gates has this whole project, right, where people are investigating their own. You're involved in
that? Yeah, I'm going to be in the next one in February.
On PBS?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Really interesting. Jessica, thank you for your call and your candor. We'll continue in a minute with Bliss Broyard, daughter of Anatole Broyard and now the author of One Drop, My Father's Hidden Life, A Story of Race and Family Secrets. And I'm going to ask you a political question about all this when we come back. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Well, we're talking about a piece of literature right now, a brand new one, a memoir by Bliss Broyard, daughter of the longtime New York Times book critic Anatole Broyard, who kept a secret from his children. Just before his death, Bliss and her brother learned that their father was part black, and she has written this memoir called One Drop, My Father's Hidden Life, A Story of Race and Family Secrets. So you were telling me during the break that the rule in many families with this kind of secret is you don't out a relative during their lifetime, but...
But you're allowed to show up at the funeral, that no one's going to turn you away from your sister or your, you know, cousin's funeral.
And is that about kind of your right to be a relative or something else?
I think it's about your right to be a relative. Although I have in my own family a story where there were two sisters, one who lived as white and one who lived as black, and the one who lived as white died. And so the one who lived as black, although she could pass for white, went out to the funeral. And the widower, the husband, started telling the priest a whole different history, that she wasn't from New Orleans. She was a Cajun from the parishes. And, you know, and this woman laughed. She said, I'm not going to listen to her life eulogized completely falsely.
Lisa in Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. My grandmother had a very similar situation. She had some cousins back in the 1920s, and they were very, very fair. And they started to pass for white. And what had happened when my grandmother costed her working in a movie theater selling tickets. She pretended like she didn't even know my grandmother.
Because if she was seen associating, then people may have figured it out.
And my grandmother took that to the grave, and it really hurt her. And to this day, we don't know where those members of the families are.
So, Bliss, would you suggest anything to Lisa in terms of, if she wants to, trying to find that estranged part of the family?
I think that I know many families that have just reached out to, if you can do a little genealogy to find the descendants of your grandmother's sister, your great aunt, if she ever married, or and find some of those cousins that you might find among the younger generations, that people are, they probably have known that there was this family rift and some kind of secret, and they may actually, you know, welcome reconnecting with the rest of the family.
I just want to say one thing, that we all are one. because with my mitochondrial DNA, we all find out that man came from Africa.
That's right. That's right.
So when you're talking about this one drop, you have always had that in your mind. Mitochondrial DNA.
Thank you very much.
Lisa, that's a wonderful point because, you know, the color line has had really real effects in people's lives. But if you look at the history of it, it's artificial. It's been created by slavery and the legacy of slavery. And in segregation in the states in the South, they had laws that named an equation of a percentage of black blood that made you black. And in Louisiana, it was one traceable ancestor, one drop.
So did knowing this, learning this about your father, change you in any way when you went from being just, you know, a woman who casually assumed she was a WASP to being on some level a woman of color? Did it change you politically? Did it change your sense of history or American society?
Absolutely. All of the above. I mean, but it didn't change me overnight. It's not like the morning after my mother told us that my father was part black and therefore we were too. I woke up and thought, oh, I'm a different person, or when I got the results of my DNA test, because now you can get your DNA tested. And it came back 13% sub-Saharan African. I didn't feel different either. What has changed me is meeting my family and learning this history. So it's the sum of my experiences. And absolutely. I mean, I think it's, you know, I've come to believe that in this country, we haven't really grappled with the legacy of slavery, you know, as we should, that it still has very long lingering effects.
And you've asked some of your friends and relatives if they see you as black or white.
Yeah, it's very hard to pin them down. They keep saying, you're Bliss, and, you know, what's wrong with that? I mean, I think one thing that I've also really realized that when you're white, you don't grapple with your identity, and people don't have strong opinions about it. But I've gotten lots of emails and people posting on, you know, various websites about what I am or what my father was or what he should be, and in a way that, you know, really connects me to a black experience.
Do you see your own relatives or friends changing their relationship to you, behavior toward you in any perceptible way now that you've, you know, come out on this?
Not much. I mean, I'm grateful that I seem to have somehow on my own chosen friends, not a product of where I was raised necessarily, which is a very sheltered, very white environment.
Where was that?
In Fairfield, Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
But I have the people that I've surrounded myself mostly my whole life, you know, are pretty open and don't seem to care what people are. Although, you know, it's hard to live in a diverse environment. I moved to New York partly for that experience. But when I go to parties, I can't help noting, you know, still how in publishing or whatever, the majority of the people there are white.
And your father even belonged to a yacht club in Connecticut.
That's
that
right.
Had no black members. So he sort of inadvertently, or do you think subversively, integrated it?
I think probably somewhere deep down he got a little thrill out of it. But, you know, I don't know how much my dad actually thought of himself as black. I mean, he really didn't believe in racial categories, and so he always placed himself above them. So I don't think he was sort of smugly, you know, congratulating himself while he was having cocktails with the trust fund husbands.
Or conversely, just using that to hide.
Yeah.
Joan in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Joan.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I have sort of a different twist on the whole thing. I'm African American, and my mother, who died recently, I sent away and did a DNA study on her, and she was, I always assumed she was African American, Native American, with maybe just a little bit of European, but the DNA came back that she was 59% European and 29% Sub-Saharan African, and the rest was Native American. And people are usually so stunned to find out that they have any African blood, but I conversely was shocked to find out that there was so much European ancestry in my family.
And how did it affect you?
Well, not at all, really, because I still consider myself African American. And my mother's family, on both sides of her family, her father was from Georgia, her mother was from upstate Connecticut, and they always considered themselves African American. So it's a family tradition, and nothing has changed.
Right, Joan. Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
The story. I guess it is different when it goes the other way, because people who know they're black or not white in America tend to have more of kind of an awareness of race.
Right, that's right. I mean, I think it's people, most African Americans, 75%, are mixed with European or Native American, according to this company DNA Print that offers this DNA testing that will give you your racial admixture, or actually they call it ancestral admixture. But, you know, for many African Americans, the knowledge that they have European ancestry is painful because it got there most likely in, you know, some kind of forced sexual relationship. I mean, there are instances where there were free people of color who willingly, free women of color who willingly aligned with European men. But, you know, there's some, obviously a lot of power kind of imbalance in those relationships. So,
Bliss Broyard, my guest on WNYC, daughter of Anatole Broyard and author of One Drop, My Father's Hidden Life, A Story of Race and Family Secrets. And you end the book with an account of DNA tests. And I'm curious what you learned about the genetic versus the social construction of race.
Well, and so far, my experience with the genetic, I sort of think of it a little bit like a parlor game. And it's not the sort of hard science that I thought would give me, you know, the absolute answer to my own racial identity. I've actually been tested 3 times. The results have come out differently each time. So I think the science is still evolving. But as another caller pointed out, I mean, what's interesting is it gives us a sense of the way the world was populated. You know, we all did begin in East Africa. At least that's what the scientists kind of agree on. And so it can be a useful information to sort of point you in the right direction to figure out the migratory paths of your own ancestors.
Do you think this would happen today if your father was a young man today? Have you given thought to whether passing is a historical phenomenon?
I have. I'm surprised when I learn that there are some people probably in their 40s who are still passing. And I think what it's more about an inherited tradition than the need for it today. I mean, we have the sense that we are who our parents were. So it's hard to sort of break the cycle to even when there's whispers and people kind of know. But, you know, many people would say that identifying as mixed or multiracial is kind of a benefit. You know, it's seen as cool. So certainly the need to pass economically doesn't exist today like it used to.
Now, we had invited listeners to call with any kind of family secret and how a reconciliation took place or not. And Raisha in, where are you, Mamaroneck?
Mamaroneck, right.
Hi. You have a different kind of story, not about race, right?
Right. No, I read actually all about the Broyard story in the New York Times, and I read it with fascination. There was another book, just to throw this in before I start, there was another book called Slaves in the Family that was written recently, which also found an entire group of African Americans within their family. So that reminded me of that story. But no, I was calling you about the fact that we have a branch of our family, actually these are first cousins to me, who we have not been able to get in touch with because my uncle, my father's my mother's brother committed suicide and was considered, you know, mentally ill. And for whatever reason, the mother of these cousins who survived simply turned that set of people against the rest of us. And although we were dying, you know, many people in our family really wanted to be in touch with this family. There has been no way. They don't answer our calls. They don't respond. They don't connect in any way.
Real quick, what do you think it's about?
Well, I guess it would be easy to say it's about fear of mental illness, fear of repeating mental illness, loyalty to one's mother, not wanting to think that, mm-hmm. you know, father's relatives are worth anything.
Yeah.
It's been very painful because it continues. We can't seem to overcome it. And we often talk, you know, the other family members talk about it, if we could only be in touch with them.
Right. Raisha, I'm going to leave it there because we're running out of time, but it's a fascinating story. And Bliss, do you relate to it even though it's not about race?
Well, yes, I do, because I think at the bottom of these rifts and or these family secrets, there's always kind of some, you know, national or societal secret or taboo, in this case, mental illness. And it just seems a shame that these things have to come between people. And all you can hope for, I suppose, is that later generations will be removed enough from the event that they can reconnect.
Have you given any thought to the nooses that have been cropping up in the news lately and our ability or inability to heal the wounds of slavery and Jim Crow?
I have. You know, that started in Jenna, Louisiana, and it just speaks to how persistent some of these racial dividers are, that the fact that there's a white tree and that the students, you know, wouldn't be welcome to sit under it. So it's, you know, it seems to me that there's still a lot of progress that's in front of us.
Needs to be made, yeah. And you probably looked at Katrina in a new light.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, many of my own family members lived in the areas that were devastated and still have not moved back. And the other sad thing is you know, the Creole culture, which is one of the most vibrant things of New Orleans and is very was very important in the beginning of American jazz and gumbo and the vernacular architecture that everybody so loves in New Orleans. And they're now dispersed everywhere. And it would be a shame if that culture dies out.
So before you go, you and your brother are both parents. What do you tell your own kids about the family history and how, at what ages?
Well, my daughter's only 15 months, so but I hope that I won't actually have to tell her that much, but she'll just grow up knowing her cousins who will, you know, vary from African-Americans to Sephardic Jews. And so all of this will just be and all the attendant food that goes with that and the language. And my husband's family grew up speaking Ladino. And so I just think that it will be her experience. And so it won't be this sort of abstract identity imposed onto her.
Do you understand your father's desire to protect you more now that you have a child?
Absolutely. I mean, I like to think that, you know, I would do whatever is in my power to protect my child. But I also think that it was a loss to be cut off from our family and our history. And so I, you know, would hope that she has all of that.
Bliss Broyard's book is called One Drop, My Father's Hidden Life, A Story of Race and Family Secrets. So interesting, and as we can tell from our callers, a lot of people have these secrets and these issues of reconciliation.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.